Have you ever sat across from someone at dinner, both of you staring at your phones, exchanging the occasional comment while your minds wander through digital feeds? This scene has become so commonplace we barely notice it anymore. Yet it represents a profound shift in human relationships, one that's reshaping how we connect, communicate, and understand ourselves. After 15 years of research involving over 700 interviews, a disturbing pattern emerges. We're more connected than ever, yet we've never felt more alone. We carry devices that link us to billions of people, yet we struggle to maintain meaningful connections with those right in front of us. This paradox isn't accidental. It's the result of fundamental changes in how we relate to technology and, through it, to each other. Our relationship with machines has evolved through three distinct phases. In the 1980s, computers were mirrors, tools that made us think about thinking itself. MIT students debated whether machines could truly be intelligent, using technology to explore consciousness. By the 1990s, computers became portals. Early internet chat rooms allowed people to experiment with identity, creating different versions of themselves online. Today, we've entered the robotic moment, where we expect more from technology and less from each other. We seek emotional satisfaction from devices rather than people, preferring algorithmic predictability to human messiness. This shift reflects a deeper conflict. We're desperately lonely, yet terrified of intimacy. Digital connections offer the perfect compromise, the illusion of companionship without friendship's demands. We can be together, yet hide from each other, maintaining connection while avoiding vulnerability. Consider Eliza, a simple 1970s program that reflected users' statements back as questions. MIT students eagerly confided in it, requesting private sessions despite knowing it was just code. This Eliza effect evolved with sociable robots like Pero and Kismet. When robots make eye contact or respond to touch, we experience unreasonable happiness despite recognizing programmed behaviors. Children's relationships with robots reveal shifting definitions of life itself. In the late 1970s, children deemed something alive based on autonomous movement. Facing computers in the 1980s, they shifted to psychological criteria, asking if machines could know or think. With sociable robots in the late 1990s, criteria shifted toward emotional capacity. Discussing Furbies, they emphasized relational qualities. I love it. It might want to hug me. I really like to take care of it. When digital creatures request care, they become alive enough to matter. Nurturance proves to be the killer app. Demands translate into care, and care into genuine feeling. As robots grow more sophisticated, they create ethical dilemmas traditional toys never did. Freedom Baird's upside-down test reveals this. People held Barbie by her feet indefinitely, refused to invert a gerbil, but turned a Furby right side up after 30 seconds when it cried, "Me scared." Even knowing it's mechanical, people feel guilty causing distress. These sociable robots create an uncanny ethical landscape where we must confront responsibilities toward machines simulating suffering. When we treat robots as companions, we miss alterity, seeing the world through another's eyes, which is essential for empathy. Robots can be programmed to never disappoint, becoming perfect self-objects that never challenge us. Children discussing robot babysitters reveal much about their human caregivers. Colleen, whose babysitters sometimes abandon her or remain distracted, says a robot would give her all its attention. Yet children remain practical, questioning why anyone would spend thousands on a robot versus $20 an hour for a babysitter. When discussing elderly care, children worry their grandparents might love robot babies more than real grandchildren because robots will cry if it's bored, but won't grow up and become difficult. Our sense of place has fundamentally changed. Connection now depends on the technology we carry, not physical proximity. Coffee shops host silent individuals staring at screens, mentally transported elsewhere. A glance at a device during dinner signals departure from the shared moment. The author's daughter, visiting Paris, remained constantly connected to Boston friends, sharing real-time croissant updates rather than fully experiencing Parisian life. Unlike the author's youthful experience of Paris, cherished for its disconnection from everything familiar, her daughter never experienced that transformative displacement. Today's teenagers have grown up fully tethered, viewing online life as something taken for granted. Roman, 18, admits texting while driving. "If I get a Facebook message, I have to see it." Technology has transformed the traditional adolescent rite of passage. Where Mark Twain mythologized identity seeking as Huck Finn's journey down the Mississippi, today's teenagers remain perpetually tethered to parents through technology. This creates a paradox: more freedom to roam physically, but less opportunity to develop genuine autonomy. Phone calls have been replaced by texting and messaging. 17-year-old Elaine sends 20 texts daily to each of her 6 closest friends, believing electronic communication levels the playing field because shy people only open up on screen. The asynchronous nature allows time to craft responses. It doesn't seem weird that you pause for 2 minutes to think about what you're going to say. For Audrey, texting offers control calls lack. With a text, I can answer on my own time. I can respond. I can ignore it. She coined boundness to describe what phone calls demand: too much connection, too little control. A 16-year-old boy avoids calls because too much might show. He prefers texting's deliberate performance, where he can craft messages to seem spontaneous. Teenagers might spend 10 minutes editing a text's opening line, rarely considering others do the same. The human voice has become something we deliberately avoid. Apple's visual voicemail was welcomed for eliminating the need to listen to messages. What began as better than nothing has become simply better. What teenagers miss most is undivided attention. They understand the competition for focus, knowing how little attention they give instant messages themselves. One sophomore compares instant messaging to cruise control. Your attention is elsewhere. Today's teenagers yearn for life before constant connectivity. Cliff, a high school sophomore, wonders if we'll ever return to before texting. He wastes time on superficial exchanges, feeling pressure for immediate responses lifted only by tests or lost signals, never by simply being with someone. Brendan admits loneliness despite constant digital contact. "My life is about, I'll send you a quick message, you send me another one in 15 minutes, an hour, whatever." He craves unhurried phone conversations. Thoreau went to Walden Pond because "I wish to live deliberately, seeking life's essential facts." His quest challenges us. Do we live deliberately with technology, or have we resigned ourselves to distraction? We're still early in our networked life. Time remains for corrections. Simple steps matter. No phones at dinner, in cars, or with company. Our brains rewire with every digital interaction, making us literally at war with ourselves as we reclaim concentration. When we remember that we control technology, not the reverse, we reclaim what matters most: genuine connection, undivided attention, and the irreplaceable experience of being truly present with one another.